There's the whistle. Go, go, go. Second half, my three subs action from the Center Circle Studios.
Second half underway, and we say hello to our friend. He is now the head coach of Creighton University's women's soccer team. You also know him from his days in Major League Soccer. And if you've lived around the Center Circle Studio, you will have seen him puttering around the soccer field for Houston High School and also as a youth coach, too. We say hello to Ross Pauley. Ross, thanks for joining me. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Now, I don't know if he wants to chime in, but I know your son Rossi is here, too. Rossi, good to see you, too. It's been a long time. How are you doing?
I'm doing really good.
Holiday break, right? What are you, like 22 now?
Yes, around there. Something. Maybe 23. I don't know. I lost count.
So, something like that. So you got a chauffeur, at least for the holiday.
That's right.
That's great. Well, it's great to see you. You're in that Creighton Blue Jay blue. We're going to talk about that in just a little bit. But before that, let's just wind the calendar all the way back, and let's just talk about the beginnings for you, your love of soccer. Where does it come from?
Well, actually, it was in Texas. I was born here in Memphis, moved to Texas early, and I remember watching the World Cup. I don't know how we got it on TV, but it was the 82 World Cup, and I just fell in love, you know, watching these guys and just the sport. And me and my brothers went outside and reenacted everything that we saw, played against each other one-on-one, and I think that's where the passion began. I was just enamored by what they did with the ball, and I wanted to master the ball. You know, I wanted to do what they did, and just grew from there.
Very envious of you because you and your brothers emulated what, you know, y'all liked. Unfortunately, my brother wanted to be a professional wrestler, and he emulated that stuff on me, so you probably came away with a fewer, you know, scrapes and bruises. So you started in Texas, but I know you had such a prolific career when you got to the Memphis area. So when did that move take place?
I was fortunate to be in Texas at that time. It was when Charlie Kadepski and Hassan, Hassan is running FC Dallas now, and it's a monster club. They gave me a foundation. They gave me a foundation of technical ability, skill, and even more so the joy of playing the game. Moved here to Memphis in seventh grade. And again, I was fortunate to be in this era here where I was surrounded by like-minded players like me that wanted to do something, wanted to play professional, wanted to be the best they could be and someday play on TV. So when I got here, ended up with Memphis FC with Richard Boot, with Kerry Talley, Mulrooney, Johnny Walker, Chris Michener, Tony Kuhn. It's unbelievable.
It was a golden time for sure, right? I mean, I'm not saying that loosely. I mean, there was a lot of not just talent on the field, but also in the coaching circles as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that you don't see no matter where, all over the country. There's very, very few that can say that one team produced four or five professionals and with the U.S. national team, and it was just special. I attribute that just being around that atmosphere of like-minded players that wanted to do something. We had Richard Boot there that was going to cultivate it, and I think that's where it came from.
Ross, and I know you won Best of the Preps. What year was that? That was like 90. You're a young guy.
I think it was 93, 94. Yeah.
Can you talk about playing for Houston High School? Because the team was loaded.
Yeah.
And what was that like to play high school ball? And let's talk a little bit about club ball, too. But high school ball is so different now that there's not much parity there. What was that like, you know, going against, you know, other good teams in the area? But also, I know at times you were playing maybe against lesser clubs, and that poses its own challenge in not just skill, but in sportsmanship as well.
Absolutely. High school is a different arena, really, of playing the game. It was a different atmosphere with it because you were playing for your school. So you'd go to school. You were actually playing for your school. I think that prepared me for college because that's what college is like.
Did you go to class in shorts?
I wore my uniform, my shin guards. No, it was really cool, you know, to play for your high school and to win state championships. And there were some good teams. If you remember at Houston, when we got there, it started with eighth and ninth grade.
Sure.
So we were young and we were playing against Christian Brothers with seniors. So that was in itself a challenge, but we rose to the challenge. And, you know, it's fun, you know, when you're playing for your school.
How much time did you spend in the office with Mr. Adkin or Rocky Graves?
I tell you, those guys are awesome. You know, that's they loved us. They loved the soccer team. They supported us. and they wanted us to be successful. I can remember them. Those are old names that you just brought up.
Dusted those off for you. At what point during your high school career did you start dreaming of bigger things in soccer?
I dreamt very early. My whole life was wanting to play at a very high level. I didn't know how high a level that was going to be, but when I was thinking of it, there wasn't a professional league in the U.S. So right. I was dreaming about going over to England, going over to Germany, going to Mexico. I don't care. You know, I wanted to play at the next level. And I explained this, and I know it now because I'm a coach. It was my lifestyle. It was a lifestyle that I chose. It wasn't just an experience of playing. I wanted to do something, so I made it my lifestyle every day to do what it took to be my best.
What did you do, for example?
It's just getting into a good routine, getting on touches on the ball no matter what. Off season is a time to get better, making sure that you're eating the right things and getting the right amount of sleep, because all it is you're trying to put yourself in the best position to be successful. And if you do something to limit it, then you're not going to be as good as you can be. And that took a long time to learn. That's something that I look back and I was cultivating that type of attitude. But that's what I'm trying to do now for these players that I'm coaching and developing. You got to make it your lifestyle of if you want to make it to that next level. It's the next level.
When you were in high school, what was the calendar like for club versus high school?
I don't remember exactly if we were a fall or spring season. Club was year-round. Any time that we were in the club environment, it was everyday type thing. High school, to me, was more of expressing yourself. It was more of being very, very creative, trying things that you don't try in other games, bigger games that mean a lot more. It was a year round. You know, there was not any time where there was time off that I can really remember.
I've heard criticism about American youth when it comes to soccer that they're afraid to make mistakes. Were you afraid to make mistakes?
There was a part of my career I was, absolutely. And I became a little bit hesitant to try those things. That's the hard thing about soccer is you make that one mistake, it could be the mistake that ends the game for you. Or, you know, then you have the players like, the best in the world. Look at what they're doing. You know, they're trying things, they're doing things, and very successful at it. And that's why they're scoring so many goals and creating goals. I want my players to be creative. I know they're going to make mistakes. It is just the way it is. But there was a time in my career I went through where I was. I played the safe way, and it was good because we kept the ball. But could I have made a little bit more difference beating that player or playing a dangerous ball through, breaking a line? Always on the defensive side. Never changed. I was going to work that. I was going to work so hard. I was going to do everything I could for the team to win the ball back. But.
Sounded like you stayed busy, which meant your parents were probably all in on this as well. Talk a little bit about your parents and what it takes to be a soccer mom or dad.
I think it's very difficult, you know, especially in the world today. But my parents, you know, I was lucky. They let me play multiple sports and let me kind of experiment of what I like the best.
What else do you do?
Baseball, swimming were two sports that really stood out.
Swimming, naturally, you have no body fat, so yeah.
No, baseball, actually, I was a pitcher, and I had to make a decision at age 12, 13, and I was up there in Texas with the draft and all that stuff.
Wow.
And I remember telling my dad, it's like, I want to play soccer. I love soccer. Baseball, I like. Soccer, I love. And he supported me. He was a baseball player growing up. And he, 100%, you know, it is why I had the success that I had. It's why I'm successful still today, is I have the people behind me supporting me no matter what. There's going to be ups and downs. You're not going to make a team. You're going to make those mistakes. You're going to be the hero. You're going to be the GOAT. You know, it's just the way it is. But if you have parents that support you and believe in you, you know, you're going to wake up the next day. It's a new day, and you're going to go at it again.
Ross Pauley joining us today. He is a two-time MLS All-Star, and he's currently the coach of Creighton women's soccer team. So you get through Houston High School, and you've already decided where you're going to go to college. Talk about the college decision process for you.
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, I was with the U.S. national team, youth national team at that time, so I had a lot of choices. I went on all my visits, ended up going to South Carolina, SMU, North Carolina, Indiana, and talked about maybe going out to the West Coast, and then Creighton, right in the middle of the country. And
Creighton?
Yeah, yeah, I know. And I remember going on these visits, and they were special schools, you know, and they were well known in the soccer world of the best, and that's where U.S. national team players should go. And then I went to Creighton, and it was unique because one of my coaches in the youth national team system, Brett Simon, was there, and he's the one that started recruiting me. So that's where that started, and I went there, and it just there was something about Creighton. It was the support that they gave. They wanted to help me achieve my dreams and goals on and off the field, and I felt it. And it was a family environment, and the team was the same way. They were kind of on the rise. They weren't at the top at that time, but I wanted to go be a part of a program to, one, be that player that takes them to the next level, and instead of just being another face in the crowd, another player, U.S. national team player with this team, I think it would have been a great career somewhere else. But when I think about that process, it was more about I felt like I was going to develop into the person, the player that I could be to move on to the next level.
How was the transition from being pretty much doing whatever you wanted to do on the field in high school to getting to D1 college? How was that for you?
It's in some ways, I look at that transition, and we went in there with some very high-level freshmen. We had an unbelievable class with Johnny Torres with us, Daniel Hernandez. We went in there, and we were cocky. we went in there, and no one was going to stop us. It was interesting because the class that was there then was big, strong, athletic, not quite technical as we were. And we were all smart, technical, wanted to move the ball and moving all over the field, creative. And I remember it was a battle. It was a battle with us freshmen and our seniors. But then we just merged together, you know, and it was a really cool thing because we wanted to go in and make a difference. We didn't want to go and just I didn't want to go in and just kind of float and be just another player. I wanted to make a difference. It was a hard transition because you're playing against older players. Freshman year was a good year, but I remember the day the first year in the tournament we made it. We played Indiana with Brian Mazenoff and Yeagley. I remember going into that game, and I thought we were going to do well. But I walked out of the game thinking, you know, I got a long way to go. Those guys they were seniors at the time, and they were a special team. And they just worked us. And we were good, and we did well. But I knew as a player, you know, I went up against Brian Mazenoff. And I was like, you know, I want to get above his level. I want to play at that level. And I remember that, and I was like, you know what? It just reinvigorated. I'm in the process of getting to where I want to go to.
So freshman year, pretty good because it sounds like you had some successes, but you also hit the brick wall of life a little bit, but sent you on an upward trajectory the rest of the way, right?
Absolutely, and we were so successful. What a fun team we had. Brett Simon ended up taking over the team, and we were just a fun team. It was such a good fit because at Creighton, we had a culture of working hard. We were going to work hard. We were going to outwork the team, but we knew we were talented too. So we actually were kind of ahead of the curve, I think, in the college game. I think there were probably four or five other college teams that obviously we ended up playing against in the Final Fours. We just were an exciting team that moved the ball, had Johnny Torres up top that was just electric, and Richard Maroney came into our team.
I heard of that guy. Memphis guy, coach here.
I still talk to those guys. You know, it was such a great experience, and even now today, it's pretty neat because Johnny Torres is now the men's coach at Creighton, and I'm the women's coach, and we actually went to Creighton together. We've known each other since we were 13, you know, and because he was in Texas when I was in Texas, So, I mean, it's just it's a neat circle that's come around.
Yeah, because you, then, because you've got Richard Mulrooney, who's the men's coach at Memphis. Then you've got Johnny Walker, who you mentioned is the assistant coach at the of the women's program here in Memphis. It's it must have been an incredible time. So you're coming down. Your days are getting numbered in college. And the World Cup comes along. And with the U.S. World Cup comes the promise of the start of a domestic league.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about how does one get wooed for the MLS draft. When do you know that people are keeping an eye on you for the next level?
Well, we were a team that was fortunate to be in the final in the NCAA championships. We made it to the Final Four twice, you know, and so you're going to get seen. That's what I wanted, why I wanted to go to Creighton. You know, I wanted to be seen. I wanted to be a player that made a difference to get the team to that next level. And, you know, we were seen. And I heard that I was one of the players that could go into the draft. I wasn't one of the top players to go into the draft that year because I was still a junior. But it was just my path. You know, I saw the league come in 96, watched it, wanted to be a part of it. I felt, you know, it was really a hard time for me because college, I think, has so many restrictions on the calendar year of how much you can do, how much you can play. And I struggled with it because I wanted to play. I wanted to develop my craft. And this is another thing in college, every off season, like I said, I wanted to improve. My summers were going over to Europe to play with. I went over and trained with PSV. I went over and trained with Werder Bremen. I went over and just tried to find places to one, get seen. You never know what's going to happen. But two, you know, I wanted to really elevate my game at all times. And I felt like college was restricting that.
Eye-opener, confidence builder, going over to Europe. What were your feelings going over there in training? What did you see? What did you learn? What did you feel?
I saw what a pro is like. You know, again, that's another part of my path of learning to make it a lifestyle. Of showing up every day and being your best. And if you don't, you're going to be passed on. So it was awesome. And I was just a little kid over there, American boy, you know, just playing. And PSV Eindhoven was so good at that time. Werder Bremen was so good at that time. And you start out with the youth teams there. And if they like you, they move you up to the 18s. They move you up to the 19s. You get moved up to the reserves. And it was a fun process because you have to prove yourself every day. And if you don't, you know, that's, you know what, you're back down with 16s. You know, so it was a neat thing. It was eye opening because you really do. It is the next level. You got to have that mentality.
Yeah. Now you come back and you do get drafted. First round, the MLS draft, 1997, the Colorado Rapids.
Yeah.
What was it like? Did you get a call? Were you there for a draft? I in those beginnings, I don't know how fancy the setup was. They say that the league first year or two was basically run around a card table, and then it just blew up from there. So talk about draft day.
Yeah, we had just got done with the Final Four. I remember telling my coach, you know, I'm going to enter the draft, so I'm done with college. Not happy, but he supported me. One thing that also kind of before the draft, I remember on the elevator with a pretty packed elevator, and there were some good players on there that were going into the draft, and a very popular Sports Illustrated writer was in there and was talking about who's going into the draft and stuff like that, and I said I was, and he goes, he said this, he said, that player right there is ready to go to MLS, you will fail.
He told that to you?
He said that to me. Yeah. So, and I was just looking at him, and that player was a friend of mine, and he goes, you're wrong. So it was one of those moments where it's the first thing a high-profile Sports Illustrated writer, you know, I was like, interesting. You know, I never heard somebody say, you're going to fail. You know, so I was like, at first, I was nervous, and then I was like, you know what?
How many matches of mine have you seen?
Going into the Major League Soccer draft, it was stressful because you know, I'm leaving Creighton, wonderful education, and I told my parents, you know, this is my path. I have to enter the draft. It's time for me to do this. I want to challenge myself. And it was a big challenge, you know. And so entered the draft. I was at my house watching it on TV, and I was picked number 11. And I remember it, Colorado Rapids, Mooch Myernick. And then all of a sudden, it all hit me. And I was like, okay, I'm in this. I got picked. What's next? So my agent called me, and he says, all right, now you go into Colorado, and you got to make the team. And okay, I got this. And so show up to Colorado. And again, you know, looking back on that, I wasn't nervous. I just believed in myself. But then when you get there and you have players like Peter Vermees, the captain of the national team at the time, Marcelo Balboa, Chris Henderson, Roy Wagerle, Sean Bartlett, all these guys just got done playing the World Cup. And I just got done playing the College Cup. So, you know, I go into it, but I was confident. You know, I had my white hair at that time.
I've seen that trading card. It's pretty awesome.
But going in, I was confident, but it was one of those things that my experiences over in Europe and seeing that that pressure every day. And I took the advice from my dad when I went to that. He said, you look at the most successful players, the players that have been pros for a long time, you learn from them, you connect with them, and you see why they're pros. And that's what I did. I watched them. I became as close as I could to them. I asked questions. I was never disrespectful. I was going to work harder than them. And I was going to earn my spot, earn the respect. And that's the pro I wanted to be. And it was just a path from there.
It's a great attitude to take, because I know you got to be going in there, one, wondering, okay, you know, am I up for this? And secondly, here are guys that are trying to make a living for that already have families established. They got to buy groceries. They see me coming in. I'm the new guy. I'm in here to take their spot. It's a team, but it also it's not a team either,
right.
Is it?
That's right. That was a really just eye-opening from the process of getting there through preseason. You know, you have a roommate, you wake up, all of a sudden your roommate's gone. That player was cut, and, you know, it was very, very cutthroat, and they were getting the roster down to 20. There were 30 of us there that were there that started. So, you know, you gotta earn your way into that team. Yeah. And there's no guarantee with anything. So that right there was the way Major League Soccer was at that time. I think it's still pretty similar. It's very cutthroat, but there's just a lot more opportunity.
So you made the team. Season starts. Where are you guys playing your matches?
We're in the Broncos Stadium.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. Yes.
Let me guess, packed 70,000 every
week.
Oh,
yeah. No, we had about 10,000 to 15,000. It looked like it was 3 to 4 because that stadium is monstrous. What an experience. You know, it's just where it was. And you could see every year it was headed in the right direction. It would drop a little bit. And then to where it is today, wow. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable when I look at it. But I look back on our time then. We felt like it was a big deal. You know, but now with the stadiums, everybody has their own stadium,
yeah.
And it's special. It's special.
So you had 4 seasons there. Things really started to click though pretty quickly because you got all-star accolades in your second and third year. Can you talk about how things were rolling for you there? How quickly you got acclimated?
Yeah, it was one of those things where I had to find my way, find a role in the team. They ended up starting me on the outside, and I was going to take whatever role I could take and make a difference. Again,
where were you before? Position wise,
I always played central midfield.
Okay.
I was always a number 10. I was either an 8 box to box. I'm a box to box player.
Yeah.
That's just who I am. I could fill in as a number 6 just because I'm a thinker. But they started me out wide because I can run. you know, I can run and up and down, and I had good technical ability to serve balls, and I was successful with it with our team.
I think we talked about this one time in a previous conversation away from here that. And maybe one of the reasons why you did so well there is because of your cardio, your God-given cardio abilities are off right. The charts.
Yeah, yeah. The thing is it is God-given, but it's you have to work on
yeah.
it. It's one of those things where if you drop that, then you aren't your best. And again, I was going to do everything I could to give myself a foundation to be successful, and that was one of them.
2-time All-Star, 98 and 99. You played with the Rapids, what, until 2000? And then...
Yeah.
And then made a move to the Metro Stars. Talk about that first professional move from one team to another, because I know that means that uproots a lot of stuff. You were already married, Lori, at
yep,
the time, right?
Yep, married and Jordy born. So we had Emma and Lori's tummy. It was an interesting time. And it was kind of a cutthroat thing the way it happened. We had Tim Hankinson come in. He was a coach down in Miami that now came up to us. I knew he loved Carlos Valderrama. I was playing central midfield at the time. I was very successful. I had 10 assists at the time, at the top of the league. And it's just the way it is when you have a new manager, and they're going to bring in their players that they think can take them to the next level. And obviously, Valderrama is a special player. But it was just, I knew my time was coming to an end.
And unless your birth certificate said Carlos Valderrama, you knew something
was
going to
go on. That's right. So showed up and got traded, and it is what it is.
So you end up with 18 goals in 111 games for Colorado. You moved to the Metro Stars for a couple of years. Talk about your time in New York. Were you playing in Giant Stadium at that time?
We were in Giant Stadium.
Playing in caverns, man.
That was a very trying experience.
Also.
In a lot of ways. We had Emma being born, something that was very trying during that time. It was actually in 2001. It was 9/11. So I actually did not get to see Emma born because it happened, and I couldn't get out of New York. So trying is you know, obviously that's very, very difficult to speak about during that time. The other thing was, you know, that it was such a talented team. When you look at that team, I'm trying to think of it. I had Tim Howard, I had Clint Mathis, I had Tab Ramos, Petke, Mamadou Diallo, Villegas, Hernandez, Richie Williams. And I went into this team. We should have won the cup easy. But we were just not. It never clicked. It was just one of those things where you had so many superstars.
And where were you dropped in on the field?
I was number 8.
Okay.
You know, I was the general. I was the one that was up and back. Box to box, fighting for the team, connecting the team, we were so good. We were so good, and I still look back on that time and how did we not win? But we ended up losing in the playoffs to LA, you know. And you look back on that and see, I just don't think our team was had the right culture at that time. It was more individualized.
Well, I remember speaking with Tim Mulqueen, who's now the head coach at Memphis 901 FC. And I know he's spoken, you know, with New York, and I know with other organizations, if you get that quick turnover or rapid turnover of coaching, the culture doesn't get to take root, and it impacts it all the way out onto the pitch.
Absolutely.
Now, let me ask you about this as captain. I've never interviewed a professional soccer captain before. I know as a youth soccer player's captain, my parents were responsible for bringing the juice boxes, but as a captain on a professional team, other than the armband and walking out first, are you the link to the bench during the match?
Absolutely. You have to be. You have to be the one that is respected. You have to be the one that can make a change on the field that's not working. If not big changes with like managers do, but you got to be the one that is the rock. You got to be the one that can help connect what your manager wants, putting it on the field. And to me, the best captains out there, you live it. It's what you do off the field, it's what you do on the field, and you have to be respected. The best captains I ever played for were the ones like that. And that's Peter Vermees.
Peter
he's,
Vermees.
I said it a couple times, but he was an amazing captain. Then you have Robin Fraser, another one.
And I know you have one more stop in MLS. Had you at this point gone back to play at Colorado at this point as a former player?
I know where you're going with this.
Do you now?
I do know where you're going.
What are you talking about, Ross?
Oh, man. I remember in the beginning of the game walking out and getting booed, first of all, by my old people that loved me, and then going out there.
It's because you made a heel turn, wrestling turn for your son over there. Yep. You're the bad guy now.
I know. I was the villain, and I really felt like a villain there. It was unbelievable, and I know where you're going with this because it's my only red card I ever got.
And what did you do?
It was the cheapest red card ever. It was two yellows, and both of them were not even bad fouls. I ended up fouling Valderrama once, and they're
you foul. See, there you go. They's like, you know, this here's animosity here. Here goes Ross Pauly.
You know, is that. It was so frustrating. You know,
did you pull his hair? No. Is that what you did?
I should have done something to earn it. But, man, what a terrible feeling. It's something, you know, I pride myself in the way I play. And I'm gonna work very hard. I'm not going to be dirty. And I felt like I got screwed there.
We move on to Columbus Crew. You had a productive time there and a good time there too, right? I mean, you had some real close friends still with them as well.
Yeah, it's my favorite place I played. And the bottom line is the best place I played because of the culture. The culture was from the day I showed up, they welcomed me as family. And I can remember it. Brian McBride, how's your family? What do you got going on? And we kind of knew each other from the All-Star games and playing against each other. And then you have players like Robin Frazier again coming in there, Duncan Outen, Simon Elliott, Frankie Haydock. Robert Warziha and Kyle Martino. You know, these are all guys that, what awesome personalities, but they are such good people. And we were so talented. I don't know if we still have the record for the most games that we went unbeaten for a certain amount of games. I don't know if we still have it or not. I'm going to say we have it, okay?
I remember that because you had a lot of great players there, and you had a great run there. I think you'd scored 11 goals there, so it was a very productive time for you, and you were team MVP in 03 for that club. And now, you know, the original Columbus Crew have moved to Austin. I know that had to be kind of I'm sure the old school guys were probably sitting around wondering what was going to be the future of Columbus soccer. I mean, obviously, right. Crew is still there now in another form.
Right.
You know, your thoughts on that when that was going on?
Yeah, it's difficult because it's such a special time for me there. The fans were some of the best fans that I played for. You know, they were diehard Crew fans, and they were there. And having your own stadium, that makes such a difference. It really felt like what I dreamt of. Playing, and we had our own training facility. We had our own stadium. Our ownership was excellent. You know, I thought our coaches really cared about us a little bit more. And I felt like just the team, the culture, again, that culture just, I'd go back to that team any day.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but Columbus Crew was the first franchise.
Yes. Yep.
So, yeah.
And they played in Buckeye Stadium.
Buckeye Stadium, and eventually was it Mapfre?
Yes.
Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
Help a brother out here. All right.
I think it is.
All right. So you played until 2005, and then you went from one side of the whistle to the other. You moved over to coaching. At what point did you decide to make that transition?
Well, I was unfortunate with the concussions. You know, I had the last year and a half of my career at Columbus. I got in trouble with concussions, and it was right in the middle of when really people were starting to pay attention to concussions. Taylor Twellman at the same time ended up getting concussions, and I still talk to him today about that. My decision was easy when the doctor told me. He said, you should never play again, but they had to tell me that. I was going to play. And finally a doctor told me you can't play. And then the transition was pretty quick because I loved coaching already. I coached in youth when I was playing as a professional, wherever I was going to find a little youth club to train. And then I was kind of lost. You know, all of a sudden I got, you can't play anymore. I said, this is my dream. You know, what do I do now? And it was kind of, the decision was I'm going to stay involved. And the coaches at Creighton, Andrew Liss, was there. And Ziggy Schmidt was there when I ended up getting my last concussions. And he said, why don't you come in and be one of our assistants? And
wow.
So I got to kind of see it from one side to the other. It was kind of too fast, though.
Yeah. And how was Lori during all this? Because I know this was not a choice that was made for you. The doctor made the choice for you. And it seems like she's kind of stood by you throughout your entire career path.
Absolutely.
I think you outdrafted everybody else on that one, didn't you?
Absolutely. Yeah. She's amazing. She's been there since the beginning. She was actually at Houston High School with me. So she's seen my whole career, seen the ups and downs. Yeah. And during that very difficult time, she was there. She knew we were going to be okay. We have very, very strong faith that we know that there's something better ahead no matter what. We know.
And let's talk about Creighton in a moment. And we have a few moments to go, but I do want to touch on that because you're a man of faith, and so am I. But what really intrigues me about you and what I think makes you great is that you're not shy about your faith, but you're not a finger wagger. I've never met anybody who's finger wagging convinced somebody of, you know, of a position or a belief. And you had a very integral role in rolling out a New Testament featuring other players giving their testimony.
Right. It's you know, I think you can live it better than you can say it. And I think if you are the an example of Christ and show the love, then I think you can make more of an impact. And to talk to other professionals that have their own testimonies and put it in the Bible, that was a special experience.
Tim Howard was in there. I think was Kaká in there. Yeah. And there's a ton of guys in there. And I think you guys distributed that to numerous countries, from what I recall.
Yeah, it was during the World Cups, and we'd send them out, over 20,000 of them.
So you'd been coaching for some time. You worked on the New Testament for players, the Players Bible, but then you got the bug to coach college.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Yeah, when I was done playing at the professional level, Ziggy took me in, and I knew that was too early to jump into that at that high level. Came back to Memphis as our hometown, and I wanted to be a part of youth development. I wanted to be a part of giving the kids a foundation that I had of skill, of technical, of joy, of playing the game. So we started our own club in Arlington, and it really progressed, and I ended up coaching my daughters and fell in love with coaching women. It was just really neat to coach your own daughters, but then again, also to see all these girls come in and buy into my philosophy of technical and enjoying the game. And I wanted to coach at a higher level.
And that's Sean Andre out in Arlington, right?
Yeah, he's there now. Yeah. He's there now, still keeping it going.
Okay, so Creighton, let's talk about how you reconnect with them. What happened?
I had been talking to Bruce Rasmussen, the AD there, throughout my career. So we stayed in touch. I didn't know I wanted to coach back there. I really didn't. But the more I got coaching at the youth level, and I just saw Creighton as such an amazing place, why I went there, it really just connects exactly what I want to do as a coach. They have the foundation there to really elevate a program on the women's side like the men's program is now. And just talking to Bruce, I said, if there's ever an opportunity, I want it.
You can't be any clearer than that. And then opportunity knocked, right?
Yeah,
so,
it did.
So now you're your licensing path. What? How much time and did you have to spend? I know as a former professional, you maybe got an express lane to a certain level, but then you had some extra credentialing you had to do, right?
I went through the same path as everybody from the bottom, grassroots.
Yeah.
And when I was in New York, I knew I wanted to go into the coaching at arena. And I was lucky enough to take a Pro B license with Bruce Arena. Actually came in, and Bob Bradley was a part of it, and it was with me, Peter Vermees, Tab Ramos, all of our teammates there. It was really cool. So there was I think there was 12 of us.
Wow.
I think there's 8 of them that are coaching in MLS right now.
Oh, that's terrific.
Yeah,
that's terrific. So you're coaching at Creighton in the Big East. And you start from scratch, and you start recruiting. Just tell us a little bit about your experience there, coaching. What you love about being a college coach. What drives you to get up every morning and be the best for Creighton?
You know, the reason why I coach is to help others achieve their dreams, both on the field and off the field in the college at the college level. You have a platform to really impact these girls in their lives and help them have a foundation for success both in the game and out of the game. And that's at the heart of it. But going into Creighton and coaching at that level, I knew I was starting at a bottom level there. When I went in, the level of play was not even close to where I wanted it to be. And it's a process. I mean, you have to at that time, you had to recruit 8th, 9th graders in order to get the top level players. And it was me learning the recruiting process. While cultivating my craft of coaching at that next level. It was frustrating because I wanted so bad to be able to impact these kids more. You know, I wanted to do more on the field. I wanted to have more opportunity, and I wanted the right character player there that wanted to just feed into it. And I didn't have it in the beginning.
You have a player named Emma Pauley on your team, right?
Yes, I do.
What does she say about Dad as a coach?
Man, you're going to have to ask her.
We may have to get her on. We may have to get her on Facebook Live or something.
No, it's been
ask
a,
her about that. How is that to have your daughter on the team?
It's awesome. I tell you, I get to see her every day. She's a hardworking player. She's very honest. She wants to make an impact there. She's going to have to work her way into the team just like everybody else. And she understands that, and she's got a really cool personality that brings to the team.
And Jordan's on your crew, right, as well, or has been support staff?
Yeah, she's support staff. She actually does some of the analytics during the game. She gets to tag players during the game, and she helps. I tell you, that girl, she is so hardworking. She does so much for me.
You sound like you're extremely happy in Omaha.
We love it. We love it. And it's only going to get better. Just the, like I said, the recruiting process is, it's a year to year thing, but, we're on the cusp of really taking it to a new level. And I got the kids in there that, want to do something special. I'm looking for those difference makers. I'm looking for the players that want to feed into the hard work, the technical, and enjoying the game, taking advantage of our beautiful stadium and also an unbelievable education at Creighton. It's one of the best in the country. So once I get people on campus and get to share my passion of what I want to do and the enjoyment of the game and the culture of our team, I knew the best part of my career was playing in a team that had an unbelievable culture. We did things that we enjoyed it. We enjoyed our training. We enjoyed traveling together. We enjoyed just the process of trying to win championships, whether you do or not. That's the culture I want. I want a culture of a team making a difference.
I wish I had cameras in here so people could see the look in your eye as you talk about this with passion. It's incredible. Ross, thank you so much for being so generous with your time during the holidays. I really appreciate you spending so much time with me today. It almost makes me forgive you for the time you scored that hat trick in summer ball on me when you could have passed and you shot every single stinking time. Man.
Hey, that's just who I am.
I love you, brother, but it's all
love
good.
Love you, too.
Ross Pauley, check him out at Creighton University. You can follow them on Twitter.
Creighton WSOC.
Okay. Check that out on Twitter and wish them the best of luck. Go Blue Jays. And Ross, thank you so much.
Thank you.
More next on My Three Subs, a soccer odyssey.
I love talking soccer, but I also love talking about real estate, too. And people ask me about both a lot. And one of the big questions I get in real estate is, how's the housing market? The housing market looks great, and interest rates are near historical lows. And really, it all comes down to, when is the time right for you? If you're ready to make your move, give me a call. Tim Van Horn at Cry Like Realtors, 901-756-8900 is my office number. Brody, can I give him my cell number? Oh, I can? Okay. 901-262-5000. That's my cell phone. You can also go to my website, timvanhorn.com. I can help you with your move around the block, around the city, around the state, and even around the world, too. I have a network of relocation certified agents just ready to help you. They are dying for your business, and I can put you in touch with those. All it takes is pick up the phone, give me a call. 901-756-8900. That's my office number. You can call me at my cell, 901-262-5000. Or just go online. Check me out at timvanhorn.com. That's timvanhorn.com with Cry Like Realtors.
This is My Three Subs, a soccer odyssey. And we have added time to the podcast.
VAR.
No, boy.
In the MLS, it seems to be working out okay.
Yeah, and we've kind of figured it out, I guess, as far as like when to use it, when to implicate it, and its implication in the game.
Yeah. Now, in England, not so much. Seems like a lot of folks are getting really hot under the collar. And I can see why, because you have some terrific goals that have been pulled off the board.
Well, and then you look at even the Liverpool and Wolves match this past weekend, right, where you had a handball. Was it a handball? Could you consider the underarm part of the hand? In my opinion, it hit more of the body and the chest area. I wouldn't have called it a handball. Even in VAR. Again, we come down to, is there enough video evidence to support the overturning of a call or the upheaval of a call? Here's the problem with that I have, and this is going back to a couple episodes where we talked about VAR. You know, we're right back into this scenario. In my opinion, in today's world, it's super easy to fix VAR across all sports, across, you know, any time that you want to implicate a video replay scenario where you're introducing technology into a human game.
How would you do it?
Simple. Technology. The technology that we have that map out GPS, that map out, you know, grid lines on the pitches and stuff like that, right? We could put a small chip in the ball, okay? And this goes for all sports. That does not affect, because we can get it so small now, you know, it would be no heavier than the socket for the ball, okay? Where you inflate the ball or deflate the ball, depending on which team you're supporting. You know, you could put something in that ball that could tell you when, where, and how that ball is going. If, say, an impact, right, were to exist on a handball, well, the data would be there to tell you that, yes, it was, in fact, impacted at this height, at this range. It's simple. The technology is there. We just have to implement it.
What about margin for error?
So this would essentially, you know, take that margin of error and shrink it exponentially, because you know where the ball is. We have the goal line technology now where you have the cameras essentially, you know, mapping the whole goal, okay?
And in England, they have the whole pitch mapped out. So that's why
they have it gridded.
They don't seem to be too concerned about offside, because they feel that the field has been mapped out. Each pitch in the Premier League has been mapped out, and that the camera angles are correct.
Exactly. So why not do it to the ball? The ball is the star of the show in any sport that you're doing, whether you're talking about football in Europe, European or Premier League, football in America, soccer in America. We have the technology. Let's make it better. Let's $10,000 man this thing and make the ball better.
Did I miss a reference? What is $10,000 man?
The $10,000 man?
Oh, you're talking about Steve Austin?
Yeah.
Not the wrestler.
Not the wrestler.
Lee Majors, the guy married Farrah Fawcett.
Right.
Okay. $6 million man. Okay, I got you.
Whatever.
Okay, sorry.
Anyway, but however much money it takes, let's make it better. Let's put this ball into today's world and actually use VAR and to its fullest capacity. Why not?
I'd love to get some thoughts on that from folks at my3subspodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear what people's takes on that.
You're going to take the human element out of the game. We already have!
I'll tell you what upsets me about VAR. I'm not even going to go down the rabbit hole of offside and the other calls. What upsets me is what I saw in the Manchester City game and I saw in the Liverpool game. Is that when a goal is scored, the opposing team immediately runs at the center referee and starts claiming there was a foul elsewhere up the field that should have stopped the play, which would have negated any scoring opportunity. So they're immediately crowding the referee, trying to get him to go to VAR to review a possible foul that happened 30 seconds earlier.
Right.
And it's now become almost as litigious as American society.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it takes away the spontaneity, it takes away the fun. I want accuracy. I'm with you. I would love to have accurate calls with this. Right now, the byproducts that we're getting are a lot of complaining from the players, trying to figure out how to game the system to see if there's anything that happened before whatever negative event impacted their team.
Right.
And
well, I think a lot of that is gamesmanship a little bit. Okay. So
well, it is. You have nothing to lose by complaining.
You have nothing to lose. Right. And then you show your manager that you have passion for whatever mistake that you may have caused the goal. Right. And then on top of that, I think a little bit is showing the fan service of, oh, no. See, there was a foul. That's just why we didn't get back in time. Ah, come on. You know, come on.
It's nothing that's going to get solved in the next 5 months or so. We're going to have to grin and bear with VAR as it is right now.
But next season, come on, this is an easy fix. You put that little chip in the stem of the balls, wherever it may be. Like I said, this could cross, you know, everything. There's got to be a company out there, whether it be Rydell or whomever is you know, creating balls for multiple sports, to sit there and go, oh, yeah, we just implemented a little chip, a little tracking chip, if you will, that tracks, you know, impact, that tracks all this other stuff. And it would be great. All the people in Vegas and all the sports betting places would love it. How fast is this guy kicking, you know? And we could actually monitor that.
That's what they, I guess, don't they have like a chip in the hockey pucks?
Yeah, you put them in the hockey pucks. Why can't you put them in the balls? Oh, it made them heavier. No, it didn't.
This summer is going to be interesting because there's something they've got to change. And even if it's a simple rewrite of the offside rule or something to the point, because it's just killing the momentum and the beauty of the game. I want the accuracy, but I also want the flow of the game, not having to sit around and wait for it to be litigated, whether or not
20 minutes scored for a VAR, darn near.
Well, that's another thing, because it adds so much extra time to the end of each half.
Yeah.
Now you have matches which used to be done in about an hour 50, hour 52.
Yep.
Now you're pushing 2 hours, perhaps even above that 2 hour mark, which is not going to be TV friendly.
No. And I think you're going to get a lot of pushback from your NBCs and your bigger corporations who do have a lot of pull, a lot of money, who are basically sustaining a lot of these different leagues. Sitting there going, you know what? It's just taking too long, guys. You know, let's speed this up. And there's got to be a way to do it.
There's got to be
a way. And there is a way to do it. They just got to pull the trigger on it.
I was going
to
say it's above my pay grade, but apparently it's not above your pay grade. You have provided a solution.
Yeah.
You should provide some drawings at my3subspodcast.com.
Yeah, sure.
Of how to do that. That would be good.
There's got to be a way. By the way, should I copyright this now?
Trademark. Yep.
It's on tape.
We got it on tape. Hey, thanks to everybody listening this week. We thank our sponsors, easeofapproval.com, also Financial Wealth Services. And we thank, of course, you, the listeners, for continuing to listen to us. We thank Ross Pauly for coming by this week. And Brody, thank you. I want to wish you a very happy new year going into 2020.
Absolutely.
And my resolution is to continue for us to tag team this and continue to grow this podcast week by week. And that's pretty much it for me today. Anything else?
Well, you can send your hate mail to @my3subspodcast or, you know, tell me I'm right. Yeah, I always love one of those emails every now and then again. @my3subspodcast@gmail.com.
As married men, we rarely get that email, so we'd appreciate it from you, from Joe and Jane Public. We would appreciate that very much. For Brody Scott, I'm Tim Van Horn. Have yourself a happy new year. This has been My Three Subs.
Yes.
There's the whistle. Thank you for listening. Check out more My Three Subs podcast, A Soccer Odyssey, at 101.9kissfm.com and on the iHeartRadio app.